When negotiations with North Korea were held, North Korea at least stopped nuclear tests and missile development. A dialogue channel should be opened as soon as possible. To do this, the U.S. should present at least some specific proposals.
The U.S. says there needs to be strong enforcement of existing sanctions on North Korea, although it will meet, quote, unconditionally. Some argue sanctions on Pyongyang need to be reviewed at least. South Korean officials have been more assertive in calling for a new approach from the U.S.
According to North Korean state media, leader Kim Jong-un also said North Korea's military might does not target South Korea, and that there should not be another war pitting the Korean people against each other. The 1950-53 Korean War ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in seeks an end-of-war declaration before he leaves office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight.
Despite their best efforts to remain focused and motivated, the staff of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza were devastated to learn that one of their colleagues was among more than 40 people killed in the Zionist regime's massacre in May. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jamila Taufik, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Nightmare for Gaza's Young Doctors. Stay tuned for more. Abir Gharbavi had never worked amid such tension before. When the Zionist regime began bombing Gaza in May, an older doctor gathered her and her colleagues in Al-Shifa Hospital. The older doctor tried to give everyone some emotional support and prepare them for the horrors about to unfold. It was the first time to Al-Gharbavi, a 20-year-old surgeon, had been on medical duty during a major offensive against Gaza. Gharbavi said soon enough, the hospital was full of dead bodies and injured people in need of immediate care. Yes, it was harder than I had imagined, but I had to focus on saving as many lives as I could, no matter how horrible the scene was. I had already known that working in such situations was a part of my job, but I was surprised by my own endurance. Gharbavi was in a different situation to many other colleagues. She was pregnant with her first child. To be honest, I was almost forgetting that I was pregnant, said Gharbavi, who has subsequently given birth. I was lucky to have my husband by my side. He is also a doctor in the same department. Being together at the hospital was comforting, but both of our families were worried about us, she said. She and her husband were only able to go home twice during the 11 days of the Zionist regime's attack. The area around Al-Shifa Hospital witnessed some of the worst violence. Al-Shifa is located close to Al-Wehda Street in Gaza City, where the Israeli regime carried out a massacre on May 16th. The Zionist regime's bombardment left a large crater in the road leading to the hospital. Because of that crater, ambulances were obstructed from traveling to and from Al-Shifa. Despite their best efforts to remain focused and motivated, the staff of Al-Shifa were devastated to learn that one of their colleagues was among more than 40 people killed in that massacre. Dr. Ayman Abu Al-Auf, head of internal medicine at the hospital, had just returned home after a day's work when his neighborhood was attacked without warning. He, his wife, and two of their children were killed, along with both his parents and many relatives. Ayman Abu Al-Auf's son Omar was injured in the massacre. Unlike his parents and siblings, he survived. Mustafa Abu Fode, 27, works in Al-Shifa's intensive care unit, where Oman was treated. We had no clue, Abu Fode said, how to tell Omar that so many of his family had been wiped out, so I can hardly describe that incident, he said. The intensive care unit's resources were already under a strain before the Israeli regime's May attack. Its staff were busy taking care of patients with COVID-19. Abu Fode said, it was very challenging for us to deal with COVID-19 and Israeli regime's assault at the same time. We had to move COVID patients to other hospitals so that we could limit the infection and control the situation. It was a complete mess. We were all frightened and stressed, but we managed to arrange everything in less than an hour, which was extremely fast under the circumstances, he said. Abu Fode had major worries of his own when the attack occurred. His father was unwell and has subsequently died. I was scared something bad might happen to him when I was not home, Abu Fode added. At the same time, I had to concentrate on my work at the ICU, which is a big responsibility. I was torn between my duty to my sick father, who supported me to become a doctor, and my professional and national duties, unquote. Today, the intensive care unit is again treating patients with COVID-19, yet nobody can forget about the terrible days of Zionist regime's May attack. I can still remember the smell of the war. The smells after the bombings were suffocating, said Abu Fode, and the blood on the hospital floor. I can also remember the fear in the people's eyes, whether they were patients or doctors. We could feel that this assault was different to the three other Israeli attacks since December 2008. The bombings were so close to the center of Gaza City. It was beyond our abilities to imagine or cope with the destruction. Mohammad Ziara, 34, is a surgeon at Al-Shifa. He had previously worked as a doctor during the Israeli regime's 51-day assault on Gaza in 2014. Although the attack in May this year was shorter in duration, Ziara concurs that it involved more targeting of Gaza City, including the neighborhood around the hospital. As the bombardment of Al-Wehda Street began in early hours of 16th of May, Ziara was about to have a coffee break. He was at a hospital gate and heading toward a cafe across the road when he heard loud explosions. He said, I was totally stunned. I didn't know which way to go. The sounds were horrifying, and it was hard to tell where exactly they were bombing. I took out my phone and I started filming. Honestly, those were the longest 2 minutes of my entire life, he added. Then I found myself running back to the hospital so that we could admit the injured and the bodies of people who had been killed. Ziara acknowledges that he remains in shock. I'm trying to look after my mental health, he said. The period after each attack isn't easier than the attack itself. Like many others in Gaza, Ziara feels that the Israeli regime may launch another attack in the future. Nobody wants to live through such a nightmare again or even imagine it, he said. But as doctors, we always must be ready. This is part of our lives in Gaza, he said.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining me on today's episode of The Lantern. Coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Here's the thing about life. It doesn't always go as we want it to. That may come as a surprise. But And naturally, you'd think that, well, it's my life, it should go as I plan, and things should run according to me and my preferences, my comfort, my convenience. But that usually isn't the case. And oftentimes, life has a way of turning out and unfolding the way it should, rather than the way we would want it to. And good news is, it's okay. That's absolutely fine. Do not panic. Everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world if life does not go according to your plan. Let's listen to a short story about this, and I'll explain how it's related to what we were talking about, and we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace, and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like there once lived a wealthy man who was bothered by severe eye pain. He consulted many physicians, but none could treat his ache. He went through a myriad of treatment procedures, but his pain persisted with more vigor. He looked and for every available solution for his pain and approached a wise monk renowned for treating various illnesses. The monk carefully observed the man's eye. The monk told the man to concentrate only on green color for a few weeks and avoid any other colors. The man was desperate to get rid of the pain and was determined, ready to go to any extent. The wealthy man appointed a group of painters and purchased barrels of green paint and directed that every object his eye was likely to fall to be painted green. After a few weeks, the monk came to visit the man to follow up on the man's progress. As the monk walked towards the man's room, the appointed painter poured a bucket of green paint on the monk. The monk could see that the whole room was painted green. As the monk inquired for the reason for painting everything green, the wealthy man said that he was only following the monk's advice to look at only green. Hearing this, the monk laughed and said, "If only you had purchased a pair of green spectacles worth just a few dollars, you could have saved a large share of your fortune. You cannot paint the world green. Dear friend, let us change our vision and the world will appear accordingly."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
If I perceive Allah, worship Allah, understand Allah, recognize Allah, acknowledge Allah as a kind, merciful, forgiving, generous Lord, then God is going to treat me thus as well. But if I choose to look at Allah as this really grudgy Lord with no slight anger management issues, waiting to prosecute me and persecute me and punish me for my innate flaws, a Lord that is constantly rebuking me and condemning me to damnation, a Lord that is just waiting around the corner to catch me, make a mistake, and then burn me in hellfire for all of eternity, then that is what's going to manifest in my life. You know what I'm trying to say? My point is that life doesn't necessarily ever go according to our plan. And that is a good thing, because through this process of me planning and then something else unfolding, Allah is trying to get me to understand that, look, I'm the boss. Things go as I plan, right? You guys plan, and I plan, and I am the best of planners, as he states in the Quran. مَكَرُوا وَمَكَرُ اللَّهُ. And I am doing this to you out of my mercy, because you don't know what's good for you. You perceive something in life as being good. عَسَى أَن تَحُبُّ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ شَرٌّ لَكُمْ. Often do you like something and it's not good for you. You perceive it as being good. You perceive it as being something that you need. You perceive it as being something that if you get it, your life is going to be complete and you're going to be the happiest person on earth. But I know, as your Lord and the creator of you and that thing, that y'all aren't good for each other. And I'm not going to give that to you. And I'm not going to let your plans in order to achieve that thing succeed. If I choose to look at that situation in a negative way and think to myself, I always fail in life. I never get what I want. I have never succeeded in anything. Allah constantly turns down my prayers. He doesn't pay attention to me. He doesn't fulfill my wishes. He is a cruel Lord, and I am a failure as a human and as a servant. And I'm going to be one miserable, sad loser of a person whose life sums up to nothing but belly aching and, you know, dumping green buckets of paint on random monks because I want something to work out by hook or by crook. But if I look at life through glasses, rose-colored glasses, or rather Sibghatullah glasses, the color that Allah paints us with. If I look at life through the mentality that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam taught us, like Sayyidah Zainab salamullah alayha, when she appeared as defeated by the enemies of God and was ridiculed by them as they claimed, look what the Lord did to you, when she had absolutely every loved one she ever knew in her life taken away from her in the most brutal, vicious way possible, and she went through a degree of trauma and abuse that no human being should experience in a lifetime, and she endured it in a very short period. She could have said, you know what, you're right. My life is over. I'm so miserable. I'm getting depression right now. By the way, I'm not throwing shade at anyone who's going through depression right now. I'm here for you and your pain is real. But Sayyidah Zainab, rather than looking at it negatively, she said, what? مَا رَأَيْتُ إِلَّا جَمِيلًا. I see nothing but beauty. She was looking at life through rose-colored glasses. Rather, Allah-colored glasses. Through the mentality, through the viewpoint of acceptance and submission toward what Allah wants for her, and she saw nothing but beauty. If we focus on the negative things in life, that's the point, basically. If we focus on the negative things in life, that's all we're gonna see. We're just gonna see red cars, we're just going to go around painting other things negatively as well. But if we choose to change our perspective and we choose to trust in Allah's kindness, then that is going to manifest in our lives. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
world is in the midst of a global energy crisis, prices in Europe, North America, and Asia have spiraled to multi-year highs in recent weeks. Energy demand is rallying as economies ramp up after the end of pandemic lockdowns, and there are dips in supplies from renewable resources. Energy demand is back today as the world economy reopens, but supply simply hasn't kept up. That is why U.S. oil prices have skyrocketed $120 since crashing to negative $40 a barrel back in April 2020. U.S. oil prices finished above $80 a barrel on Monday for the first time in nearly 7 years. High gas prices will only exacerbate elevated inflation and squeeze the budgets of ordinary families.
Well, we got a little bit of a return of demand as the growth comes off the floor during the COVID era here, and we got economies that are trying to recover. So there's a little bit of that going on. But because it's going on, I believe that global speculators are really responsible for the most of the recent surge in global commodities in general, including oil, natural gas, and so forth.
In Britain, a shortage of the truck drivers who move fuel has led to panic buying amid fears of a shortage. After Brexit, many European truck drivers went back to their home countries and never returned. Some in Europe accuse Russia of deliberately restricting gas flows to the continent. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has brushed off allegations that Moscow is using energy as a weapon, saying that Europe's gas shortage is largely caused by systematic flaws in the continent's energy market. European electricity and gas prices have skyrocketed this year as tight gas supplies have collided with strong demand in economies recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. The International Monetary Fund says persistent supply chain disruptions and inflation pressures are constraining the global economic recovery from the pandemic.
I don't think, however, that this is going to continue for very much longer. The global economy is really weaker than some say. And I think when the GDP figures come out soon for the U.S., for the third quarter, fourth quarter, it'll be clear that we don't have a runaway recovery. We have a rebound going on, but we don't have a really robust, sustained economic recovery.
Iran says it is ready to resolve the global energy crisis, provided that the oppressive U.S. sanctions are lifted. Oil Minister Javad Oji said that Iran has shown several times its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. However, illegal U.S. sanctions have hindered Tehran to reach that goal. He said that Iran has repeatedly declared that it would be able to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage of fuel.
You know, the problem with natural gas is that the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Europe and others because it wants to export more natural gas. It's got an excess of natural gas, and that means it will dampen prices and profits of natural gas in the U.S. So the U.S. has had a policy since Trump of exporting and putting pressure on other countries to accept U.S. natural gas, even though it's more expensive than, say, Russian natural gas for Europe.
Europe is heavily reliant on energy supplies from Russia. Amid the current energy crisis, Ukraine and other Eastern European countries accuse Moscow of withholding gas supplies to pressure the West. The European Commission has announced a package of measures to alleviate an energy price surge that has sent bills skyrocketing across Europe. The approval of tax cuts and the joint purchase of fuel by EU members were among the proposals put forward. The European Commission has been under pressure to act on the price crunch. The wholesale price of gas has increased by 250% since January, triggering a knock-on spike in costs for consumers and businesses. However, countries like Iran and Venezuela are more than willing and more than able to provide the world with much-needed energy.
Lebanon is on the edge in the wake of a deadly attack on protesters in the capital, Beirut, on Thursday. Chaotic scenes erupted as gunmen opened fire on supporters of resistance movement Hezbollah and the Amal movement. Lebanese Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi said snipers aimed at people's heads. The protesters were marching near the Justice Palace to demand the removal of the judge investigating the massive blast at Beirut's port last year. Hezbollah and Amal blamed the Lebanese forces, a Christian party, for the attack. They said the bloodshed was aimed at dragging Lebanon into conflict. Lebanon has been moving from crisis to crisis over the past years and is now suffering from a crippling economic meltdown. Who benefits from violence and possible sectarian strife at this critical point?
There are numerous actors within Lebanon as well as in the region and internationally that would of course benefit from destabilization of Lebanon and that would love to see more insecurity within Lebanon. This is of course primarily the Zionist entity, the Israeli regime, as well as of course the United States to some extent and their regional allies as well as proxies within Lebanon that have been invested for many years now in trying to coerce the resistance, particularly Hezbollah, into disarming in order to further put Lebanon into their own sphere of influence.
The latest violence is tied to the ongoing probe into last year's mega explosion. The investigation is led by controversial judge Tarek Bitar. Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah have become increasingly outspoken in their criticism of the blast probe. The ongoing investigation into last year's huge blast has become a serious bone of contention among political parties in Lebanon. Lebanese people want the real culprits to be held accountable, but the probe has been dogged with controversy and is failing to move forward. The investigation has been suspended on several occasions, with its lead judges accused of bias. Two former cabinet ministers, Ali Hassan Khalil and Ghazi Zaitar, who are currently lawmakers with the Amal movement, are now at the center of controversy. Investigators have accused them and other prominent politicians, like former caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, of negligence. Hezbollah and Amal insist that the investigation is highly politicized and is somehow targeting their allies. The national probe has become extremely complicated and threatens to deepen the problems of the crisis-hit country.
There have been major difficulties in actually proceeding with the process and with the judiciary dimension of it. And one reason for that is, of course, that the court blast has been politicized right from the beginning. There were also issues with transparency, and Hezbollah has demanded to make the reports public, also the reports that were drafted by foreign investigations, which other parties have refused, and Hezbollah has also asked the judiciary to be investigated, which is what the judge apparently has refused.
Observers believe Lebanon needs to find a way to overcome problems in the inquiry very quickly, and then focus on its crippling economic woes if it wants to prevent the system from total collapse. An unprecedented economic crisis has left Lebanon severely short of fuel and other basic necessities. Will different political parties be able to bridge their differences and try to save their country?
Thousands of protesters rallied in support of the European Union across Poland on Sunday. Organizers said the demonstrations were held in more than 100 Polish towns and cities and several cities abroad. The demonstrators were angry at the controversial court ruling issued on Thursday that raised concerns the country might eventually leave the EU. But unlike the United Kingdom, whose people voted to leave the EU in the 2016 Brexit referendum, opinion polls show a majority of Poles want their country to remain in the bloc. The demonstrations were called by former EU chief Donald Tusk, now the leader of the country's main opposition grouping, Civic Platform. Speaking to a large crowd in Warsaw, he called on people to defend European Poland. Poland's Constitutional Tribunal ruled on Thursday that some provisions of the EU treaties and court rulings are incompatible with the Polish Constitution. The ruling essentially rejects the primacy of EU law over national legislation.
Essentially, it's a constitutional contest as to whose law is supreme. The EU's law or Poland's law, and actually the policy in both cases is actually unclear. Poland's constitution is supreme, except that it must conform with EU policy regarding judicial independence and other such issues. And the Kaczynski government in Poland is determined to crack down on judicial independence. So there seems to be a collision taking place.
The move was the latest event escalating the tensions in the ties between Brussels and Warsaw since the right-wing Law and Justice Party came to power in Poland in 2015. After winning the presidential and parliamentary elections in 2015, the Law and Justice Party started implementing changes to Poland's judicial system. The country's new president, Andrzej Duda, replaced several constitutional judge appointees by the previous government with those supported by the ruling party. The move, the European Union argues, breached Polish laws. The ruling PIS then moved to establish a disciplinary chamber to penalize judges who otherwise enjoy broad protection from political or parliamentary influence. It argued that the chamber was needed to hold judges accountable and purge the judiciary from the remnants of the communist-era judges who are still serving in the country. The move was rejected by the EU as incompatible with European law. In December 2020, EU members unanimously agreed to link respect for the rule of law to the access of EU funds. Among the 27 member states, Hungary and Poland agreed to the measure only if they were allowed to challenge it at the Luxembourg-based court. The rule of law mechanism is putting tens of billions of dollars in European aid to Poland at risk, as the bloc contends that the country no longer has an independent judiciary system.
But the problem is that in the case of the Federation, it's not really clear who's in charge, who's really dominant, and so there's a contest of wills. And if you ask whether the EU is overextended, the answer is probably yes. I mean, the EU has lost Britain, obviously. Italy is heading off in an increasingly dangerous and fascistic direction, which is very threatening to the EU's core mission. And countries like Poland, Hungary, and the Baltics are in open revolt against the EU. And it's not clear that the EU can make its authority felt in those areas.
Poland is arguing that the European laws are infringing on its sovereignty, something that the Polish authorities aren't expected to take lightly. The issue is, how far does Brussels want to push things, and whether that would lead to the Union losing another member?
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir Group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they tried to disrupt Iraq and Syria and tried to cause a major stabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind the Friday terrorist attack targeting worshippers at a packed Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The bitter, tragic incident involving a blast at the mosque of Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the deaths of a large number of faithful worshippers, saddened us. Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take necessary measures to prevent a recurrence of such tragedies. In fact, Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for several attacks in Afghanistan in recent weeks. This has put the Taliban under pressure because the newly formed rule vowed to provide safety for Afghans when it took power in August. Therefore, the Taliban has vowed to find and punish the perpetrators. They also have destroyed a cell belonging to Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, recently.
You know, we're hoping that the Taliban will make the right moves and treat this as a terrorist attack on its people. And this obviously shows a sign of weakness for the Taliban if they do not prosecute these criminals and these terrorists. And it shows that there is an open door, an open hand to attack people inside Afghanistan. And that show a bad sign for Afghanistan's new administration. So if they really want to show strength, and they want to show unity, and they want to show that they are in control, they must prosecute these criminals, and also to stop further attacks like this that could cause sectarian problems as well in the whole region.
Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai had once said in an interview that the U.S. is colluding with Daesh in Afghanistan and allowing the Takfiris to flourish in the conflict-stricken country. In addition, many U.S. officials have confessed to Washington being responsible for Daesh's creation. Now that this unholy child of Washington's flawed policies in the Middle East is causing trouble, it's likely that we are going to see a major confrontation between Daesh and the Taliban in the near future.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, I be. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms, you're listening to the one, the only youth station.
Choo-choo-ka-choo. It's the youth station for you. Sorry.
You're just waiting for it.
I have to throw that in there, yeah. You were waiting for it, though. I could sense it. Yeah.
Anyway, I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have my brother in faith and humanity and my co-host on the show.
Muzaffar Haider, at your service.
He's okay. I tolerate him. I often compare myself to you.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I do that as well, actually.
When we're hosting. No, I'm serious.
I compare myself to you as well. It's very difficult to walk in your shadow, sister. You should tone it down a little bit.
My God. Well, you set the bar pretty low for yourself by comparing yourself to me, but I compare myself to you so that I can be on your length wave.
Yeah, I think that's a very natural thing for people to do.
Yeah.
Especially in the media environment, because
exactly.
You're constantly looking at the way that people are presenting. It's all about a show, isn't it?
So it is all about a show.
To an extent, you are always going to be, Yeah, looking at what is being shown by another person so that you can perhaps show the same thing or show better than that.
It or show the entire opposite, you know?
Yeah, do something to stay in the limelight, you know?
Exactly. I feel like as human beings, we compare ourselves to others, at least, all the time from the moment we're born, if we have siblings. Right? Yeah. Brothers and sisters are all constantly comparing each other. Like, my niece, she's 6, and her baby sister is 2, just.
Mashallah, okay.
Right? And though she understands that her baby sister is intelligently inferior to her, and even physically in certain aspects, she's constantly comparing herself to the baby sister and asking, why does the little one get away with certain things?
Oh, that's cute. Yeah, no.
She get more, like, special attention and stuff like that. And maybe it's a natural thing that we do.
It's actually a perfect example of where this kind of behavior starts from. It starts from sibling rivalry. It's why our forefathers, you know, Habil and Qabil, actually, you know, they
killed each other.
Yeah, one of them killed the other. But yeah, that's where it starts, I guess. And when you compare, there's only two outcomes. Either it's going to be a good outcome or a bad one. So yeah, comparing yourself to others is actually really self-destructive, or it could be, potentially, really self-destructive. Because, okay, naturally you think to yourself you need to have a role model. But then sometimes when you create a role model, it damages you, right? So Islam is teaching us to use our intellect. But we have another faculty, which is the faculty of wahm, which is imagination. Often what happens is whenever we approach accomplishing something for ourselves, like we want to get physically fit, for example, we want to get intelligent, for example, we want to get money, for example, we set ourselves and we create an icon, an idol.
Yeah.
Right? We take somebody who's a celebrity or a sports icon, for example, and what we do is we project our self-image onto them. What we do is we compare ourselves to that image that we've created in our minds. Then what happens? What happens is you try to aspire to that thing that you've created in your mind. It's an idol. It's an imaginary thing that you've just created, right? It's like, I don't know, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but with my face on it, right? Right? And now I'm working out. And you only work out for like 1 day, 2 days. You diet for a day or 3 days, maximum a week. After that, what happens? You give up.
Why?
Because you had created an idol, that image, that icon in your head, I want to aspire to that. And after the 5th day, you looked in the mirror and you were like, I'm nowhere close to that. And it just brought you down. It depressed you. It made you feel like you can't be that good.
Brothers and sisters, we're going to go on a short break, so please stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You are listening to Youth Station, and we have been talking about comparing ourselves with others. We have a hadith that tells us about how we're meant to compare ourselves to other people. And we, like, even in the case of idolizing and setting role models and exemplars for yourself, even the Quran is constantly telling us, okay, Rasulullah is your uswatun hasana, and Allah is constantly mentioning the stories of past prophets and nations and telling us to take them as...
That's a very good point, yeah.
Like, compare yourselves with them and see whether you're good enough, you're going astray like they are, don't let history repeat itself. So I'm thinking to myself, like every other thing, comparing probably has pros and cons.
Yeah.
We're supposed to compare ourselves to things that we can hold at a realistic standard.
Okay.
One would think that how is holding an infallible as, you know, role model even realistic, yo?
Yeah,
or a prophet.
Well, you're supposed to have a really, really, really good role model, because then if you're aspiring to reach 100% and you don't make it that far, then you'll make it to, let's say, 90%.
Shoot for the moon.
Yeah, shoot for the moon. If you miss, you'll land among the stars. Although the stars are further away, so which one is better?
You know, that's a very good point.
It's always confused me, that analogy, right? And like, if you shot for the moon and then You landed on the clouds.
Well, clouds are just dense water. You'd fall through and die.
You would die. So that, I don't know. That analogy was like...
So maybe not shoot for the moon ever?
Don't shoot for the moon. But do aspire to be a better person.
And don't get the moon involved.
Right.
All
right. Okay, if we take an example like who is not an infallible per se, not marasum, somebody like Salman al-Farsi. You know, Salmanu minna ahlul bayt. He's from us. Salman is from us, the ahlul bayt, which meant that he actually... transcended to such a great extent, he actually ended up in the family of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. So there's many phases that we have to get
by
through.
Doing what though?
See, I don't know what he did.
There's a hadith once. It was raining, right, and the ground was a little slushy, muddy, fudgy, right. And Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had walked out of a house or his house toward the masjid or toward a destination, and he left footprints in the ground. And then Salman followed him, right? As he would, because Salman was always with him. And then Abu Dhar came along, or maybe another Sahabi. And looking for Rasulullah, Salman said that, yeah, he's going this way as I am going. And then the Sahabi was like, there's only one set of footprints. And Salman was like, yeah, that's Rasulullah's. I stepped exactly where he stepped. You know what I mean? Salman became Salman because, again, he set the Ahlul Bayt as role models and he followed in their footsteps in every sense of the word, even literally.
Literally.
I'm thinking that, like, oh, there's a hadith. I think Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says that when comparing yourself, comparing your spirituality, compare with yourself with those who are better than you. And when it comes to material things, compare yourselves with those who have less than you.
Subhanallah. Yeah, and that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. True, though. That's an honest answer. I'll give you that. Yeah. Because depending on the situation, you're going to...
The field, the topic of things. I mean, I'm not going to set...
No, but which out of the Ahlul Bayt stands out to you, the prophets or imams, you know, which one of them stands out for you as a, for you, as a personal kind of... Because people are attracted to different... For example, out of the 12 imams, you always find this one that you're more attracted to.
Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Okay, all right. So view it to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yeah, because I don't know, maybe because the history we have about him is the most abundant, rich, a lot.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, partly it's because we have so much more information. We're so much more familiar with that imam.
Exactly, and we don't know that much about all the other imams. That's one. And then I feel that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, his personality is just so diverse.
It is diverse. It's complex. You
know? Yes, very, very.
You can
almost relate to him in every field. For a sec, we're going to go for a short break and be right back. When it comes to someone like Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, we just focus on that climax of his life, which was Ashura. And you can't necessarily always, like, there is, no? It's relatable to every aspect of life, but we have trouble finding it. When it comes to comparing ourselves with others, I don't know. See, I feel like comparison is such a two-pronged sword. On one hand, I feel like comparison is something is one of the reasons why a lot of youth are struggling with body image. They're struggling with identity. They're struggling with who and what they are in society right now. They're struggling socially, whether it's social media or actual social. But then on the other hand, I feel like at a certain age onward, you sort of have to compare yourself with others in certain matters. That's a lot of certains in one sense. Like, when it comes to body image, right? It doesn't matter whether you're skinny or you're fat as long as you're healthy and happy with yourself, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You need to be healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not even happy. Healthy first,
healthy,
then happy.
Healthy is the most... I mean, you'd be happy if you were healthy, right?
Well, no, some people are, like, obese.
And they're happy.
They're happy with their lifestyle. It doesn't bother them.
But they're not healthy.
But they're not healthy. Right. They're, like, And some people are, like, super-duper skinny, and that's not necessarily healthy either, but they feel like, oh, I'm a supermodel. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe, like, comparing... I don't know the psychological logic behind it, but I think, okay, while we're teens, we shouldn't compare till a certain age.
It's impossible, isn't it? Which teenager doesn't compare themselves to the popular girl in the class or to some celebrity?
And then, yeah, exactly. It's really hard to say, but then... During that age that we do it the most, we shouldn't be doing it the most. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because you're most sensitive at that age, right?
Yeah.
I remember being really, like, vulnerable.
Vulnerable, you know,
as a teenager, yeah, you're really vulnerable. It's a horrible world when you're a teenager.
It is a horrible world.
Yeah.
It's both a wonderful world and a horrible world. It's wonderful because you're still so wide-eyed and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're getting doses of reality here and there, and it's just like hitting you like a bus.
Right, yeah. You do need a comparison, though, because, okay, who is your... Okay, now this is an easier question.
What?
Who was your role model when you were a teenager in that vulnerable phase of life where you're looking for...
I don't know, some pop star. All right, so that's basically all the time we have for today, but just to wrap it up, we'd have to say that when it comes to spirituality, like the Ahlul Bayt said, compare ourselves with those who are higher. When it comes to material things, compare ourselves with those who have less. So it gives us perspective and it creates a balance.
Right.
And also we have yet to discuss whether or not comparing ourselves to others is actually fundamentally a good thing at all.
Mm.
Right? That and much more in future episodes of Youth Station. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love, my love is strong.
IRIB English Radio.